Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Dr. Irakli Loladze. He earned his BA degree in Applied Mathematics in Georgia, the former USSR, not Atlanta. After earning his MA and PhD in Mathematics at Arizona State University, Irakli, as a postdoctoral researcher at Princeton University, advanced the hypothesis that rising atmospheric CO2 is affecting human nutrition by worsening the quality of plants worldwide. It took him 12 years to collect the empirical evidence confirming the hypothesis. He is now an associate professor of biomedical sciences at Bryan College of Health Sciences, Bryan Medical Center. So first off, thank you for doing all this very important work. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
So my first question is, so what is the relationship between atmospheric CO2 and the nutritional value of plants, and how did you come across it?
I see. So, you know, CO2 is the basic raw ingredient for plants to build their biomass. What they do, I mean, what photosynthesis is that plants take those CO2 molecules in the air, and then they split the water molecules, and they take, you know, hydrogen from water molecules, combine it with CO2, and make sugar and starches. And, you know, when there is more CO2, then they make more sugar and starches. And the quality or other nutrients might end up being diluted. This is in very simple and basic terms, but of course, plants are much more complex organisms, and it's one of the reasons I had so much resistance to advancing it and convincing people that's happening. The plants are very interesting organisms. They actually make their own food. And imagine being stuck at one place. You can't move. And you have to synthesize, literally, a food from just basic, you know, elements in the soil. And that's why plants, I mean, they're very, very complex. They're like, for example, wheat. Wheat has the number of genes is several times larger than human genome. And their biosynthesis machinery is fascinating, and they have to deal with intermittent supply of, you know, nutrients and water or weather, right? We can't, with our best computers, can't predict weather, you know, 1 month in advance, and plants have to deal with that randomness and make all the food that they need. And if you look from that complexity perspective, there's so much plants can do, like they increase the number of roots, or you know, they can grow more shoots, and they interact with microorganisms in soil, and they do some kind of trade-offs with those microorganisms. So if you look from that perspective, then it's not easy to say what plants gonna do if environment changes. And you know, plant experts that obviously know so much about plants, they have that complexity perspective, and so they are reluctant to you know, maybe accept some simple sounding but broad reaching conclusions. But I grew up, I was educated as a mathematician, so I really didn't know much about plants. And in some way, that really what helped me, as I was getting my PhD at Arizona State University, I was fortunate to pop up into a lab of a biologist there, Professor James Elser. And he was like looking at all this ecology and biology from very simple perspective of chemical elements. You know, it may sound boring, chemical elements, but it was really exciting to me because there are only few basic elements, like, you know, carbon, nitrogen, phosphorus, and the all life is based upon. And he was looking just at those ratios. And as a mathematician, I thought, okay, so it doesn't matter how complicated an organism is, still has to obey basic physical laws, basic chemical laws. And if you think from this perspective, then here's two interesting things we can say about plants, right? So plants are this factory, right? They have to make their own food. Well, if they're a factory, then they gotta have a storage, right? They have to store somewhere those, you know, raw ingredients and then the products of this, the output of the factory. And then indeed, if you look into a plant cell, they would have this huge vacuole, central vacuole, where they can store all kinds of stuff like a warehouse. And when you say eat an apple, juicy apple, a lot of it, what you're actually eating is plant vacuoles. In animal cells, they don't really have those such a big storage compartments because animal cells don't make their own food. So that then means that plants inherently have very flexible chemical composition, plant cells, because they have this huge vacuole. And when you grow and stuck in one place and, you know, some nutrients might be available, might not, you become an opportunist. So all plants are opportunists. If they see there is more of some kind of nutrient, they take it up. And of course, we took advantage of that. That's why this synthetic fertilizer industry, dominates now, right, all the food production. Because if you add more nitrogen, they definitely respond. Plants take it up. They respond. But one thing that we do, and we do it globally, is that we increase CO2, the basic ingredient for plants. And they definitely take it up. They like it. They like there is more CO2, and they start to make more sugars and starches, because they just can. And they store that extra starch and sugar in their storage compartments. And it doesn't really hurt them. I mean, just in case they want to have it. While they do that, they absolutely don't care about our nutrition, right? The amount of zinc or magnesium we get, this is not something they really concern about, you know. We actually eat them, so in some way we're kind of their enemies. And from this simple perspective, if you look at that, then you see there's some global trends, right? You see, okay, well, plants have a very variable chemical composition, each plant cell, and then we increase globally and largely uniformly the amount of their basic ingredient that makes sugars and starches. And we know that plants are opportunists, so they're gonna take advantage of that. Well, how that will affect us, that's the question I asked while being a postdoc. And, that's where it took from there.
So one would think that increased sugars and increased starches, doesn't that make it so the plants are tastier? And so any deer who eats some of the plant, or elk or human or anybody else, that's going to actually give them more sugars. Isn't that more fuel for the herbivore?
Right. Yes. In fact, the ratio of carbohydrates to protein increases in most plants worldwide. And, if herbivore or plant eater is limited by energy or calories, then there could be a benefit. The problem, of course, with humans is that the majority of humans are not limited by calories. If anything, we consume an excess of calories. And why was I really able to connect it to human nutrition is that when I looked at the state of human nutrition, I was shocked to find at the time that the so-called hidden hunger was considered, and I think still is considered, to be the most widespread nutritional disorder in the world. And what is a hidden hunger is that when you get enough calories but not enough nutrients. Zinc deficiency is affecting over 1 billion people in the world. There are different estimates for calcium deficiency, but one of the most recent ones puts it at the half of all the world's population. iron deficiency is a very big problem in areas with, you know, insufficient meat consumption in mostly plant-based diets, and it's especially for women and childbearing women, as they women have a higher requirements for iron than men. And so we talk about billions of people that are affected and don't get enough nutrients. So that my question was, what will happen if those nutrients decline?
So in some of the early studies, and correct me if I'm wrong, but weren't there phytoplankton and zooplankton involved?
Right. So what's interesting is, in some way, how the ecology developed. I was a mathematician, but I was keenly interested, and still interested in ecology. And, when I looked at this history of the way the ecology developed, initially, there was a lot of focus on, you know, also on elements and quality, but then they really shifted toward energy. You know, like when they analyze the ecosystems, the ecologists will look how much, you know, this energy pyramids, how much energy cascades, how much calories cascade from one trophic level to another level. So when I was working on mathematical models in ecology, population dynamics models, they really, practically all of them, measured populations purely as biomasses. In other words, it was just quantity. Right. And which in some way contradicted with common sense. We know that quality matters, but it was totally absent in this population dynamics theory. And there were some experiments on plankton that started to show that. And, you know, James Elser showed me those experiments, the work of Tom Anderson in Norway. And where the quality of phytoplankton, those tiny green cells that are in the ocean and lakes, that their quality affected zooplankton. And there were also experiments by James Elser's colleague, Bob Sterner, with the Jotaro Urabe in Japan. And they actually manipulated the quality of algae or phytoplankton by increasing light. In other words, if you shine more light, then photosynthesis increases, right? Plants love light, up to a point, of course. And so when you increase the light, they start to make more sugars and starches, and the amount of other nutrients dilutes, decreases. And so what they observed was that zooplankton eating this phytoplankton essentially kind of was starting to eat junk food. It would get enough calories, but not enough phosphorus. That was the limiting nutrient. And it really is in many, you know, oceans and lakes. And so that was a very clear, simple, elegant demonstration of food quality affecting population dynamics, affecting how species interact. In one of the experiments, actually, zooplankton was driven to extinction. In other words, the quality was so bad that it was surrounded with all the food, but couldn't get those phosphorus, right? And, you know, if you cannot get basic mineral, you are really stuck. You cannot convert one mineral to another, right? Transmutations are impossible. No organism can convert one element into another. So you literally, just die. And that's what happened. So that motivated me to come up with a very simple mathematical model that would capture that food quality effect.
So this one of the things you're saying about the various limitations or a limiting, not being limited by energy, but by specific minerals, reminds me of studies that have been done about, you know, salmon go out to the ocean and then they swim into the forest and then they spawn and they die. And that's a huge source of nutrients. And one that they followed specifically, I can't remember if it's potassium or phosphorus, but it ends up that forests that have salmon come up them will grow like 30% faster. Because, and they can check the isotopes to make sure they came from the ocean. Mm-hmm. And it's either potassium or phosphorus, but they can, that ends up being one of the limiting factors for the trees next to the stream. And yeah, there's all sorts of other nutrients and all the, you know, carbon provided by the fish. But what, one of the things that's really important is this either potassium or phosphorus. I don't remember which.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, indeed, right? So, the salmon then with their biomass are like essentially become fertilizers, and you know, they do it for their offspring first of all, but also as a side effect, they feed plants. And as I say, plants are opportunists. If they see there's, you know, decaying salmon releasing nutrients, they grab it up. Yes, and plants cannot get carbon from the salmon. They cannot get calories, right? But they will take those minerals. And it could be very well the phosphorus, could be potassium, could be nitrogen. It depends what particular element limits that plant. Generally, worldwide, all the primary production are mostly limited by two elements, and that is nitrogen and phosphorus. And because these two elements are in our DNA and RNA, really. I mean, they're very basic building blocks, and that's why, not surprising, you know, humans essentially hijacked the nitrogen cycle, where we need to feed us, we need this nitrogen, and we produce synthetic fertilizers and we dump them on agricultural fields to increase the yield, to make even more food.
So you're talking about, as CO2 increases, that the plants will have more sugars and less of some other important nutrients. How big of a problem is this? Is this like it's 1% less, or is it 97% less? And obviously it's going to be different with different plants and different elements, but how big of a problem is this?
Right. So, you know, one of the challenges was, you know, when I was focusing specifically on minerals, because, you know, at the time in late 1990s, we already knew that, when CO2 increases, plants have less nitrogen. They actually need less nitrogen. And the reason why is because they use nitrogen, and specifically enzyme Rubisco, which is, some say, is the most, abundant protein on Earth, to capture CO2. So when you have more CO2 in the air, plants say, hey, we don't need that many enzymes to capture CO2, and their requirements for nitrogen decline. So this was known, and the decline was about 15%. If you double CO2 concentration, then nitrogen declines by 15%. And, you know, agronomists viewed that as something positive. They thought, okay, plants, you know, we need less fertilizers. But when you start to look at minerals, first of all, there are many minerals, right? They're like, you know, plants require at least, you know, like 13 different elements. And as you mentioned, there are different plants, right? And different climatic conditions. And if you start to analyze, say, you run the experiment, here is wheat in ambient or present CO2 concentrations, and here is a wheat grown in identical conditions, but say we double CO2 concentration, right? Say from, you know, 350 parts per million, which was, you know, like in 80s, 90s, to 700 parts per million, which we might experience in our lifetime, or our children could experience in their lifetime. So you run those experiments, you start to analyze wheat, and then you see all kind of disarray, you know. Maybe iron increased in one experiment. Maybe zinc decreased. Maybe changes are statistically not significant. And because of the costs, scientists used small sample sizes, like maybe 3, 4, 5, 6. So they didn't really see a pattern. They didn't see a pattern that some minerals should decline in all plants. In fact, the argument was that, you know, if plants need nutrients, they could grow more roots and get them. So, you know, if you look at it from the plant perspective, what a plant needs, then it's hard to make an argument that something should globally decline. But I wasn't looking at it from the plant perspective. I was looking at it from what humans need. And then you see that the plants, because they have this variable composition, they don't mind if they have less zinc. If it doesn't hurt their growth, they can have less zinc. They can have 5, 10, 15%, 20% less zinc. It's not a problem for them.
In fact, it's kind of good if it makes it less nutritious, because that's been the big sort of arms race between plants and herbivores for forever, is that an herbivore wants to eat the plant, and then the plant comes up and with a way to make itself taste bad or to make itself, I mean, the plant doesn't particularly want to be eaten. So if it's less nutritious, hooray for the plant from the plant's perspective.
Exactly, absolutely. And in fact, you know, CO2, extra CO2 gives plants more raw materials. Those starches and sugars they can use to build, you know, different defense compounds against herbivores, and like tannins and other compounds. So yes, absolutely, plants don't mind dropping their nutritional quality where the baseline is what's optimal for consumers, right? Dropping that quality would actually works for them. Unfortunately, essentially the big agriculture is also not concerned about quality. It's primarily yield and, you know, quantity. And in this case, this extra CO2 and, you know, this nitrogen fertilizers, they all contribute to bigger plants, more crops, more yield. But quality, even the concerns about quality are really washed out and are not considered routinely, because the profit does not depend on the amount of zinc in wheat grains or rice grains. And that's the fundamental problem we face.
And I know that this is not directly in your study, but I've also been reading that because of soil depletion, that various vegetables have become significantly less nutritious since World War II. And it seems when you combine these, that makes an even worse health problem. You know, combine the increased CO2 with the depletion of soils, and you've got even less nutritional value in the plants.
That's right. Yeah, there were two studies. One, there was a British study by Anna Marie Mayer, and one in the U.S. by Donald Davis, where they looked at fruits and vegetables that were contemporary ones and compared those with going back several decades. And they do observe declines in their quality. Now, the question is why, right? And there are several reasons that could happen, right? Certainly, it's the chase for high yields and breeding for high yields. So there's a fundamental trade-off between quantity and quality, right? A second thing is that synthetic fertilizers that primarily add nitrogen and phosphorus and potassium, because these are the ones that affect yield. Another reason is just generally depletion of soils, right, on a massive scale, where these soils are overtaxed, and the microbes there and rich flora are essentially decimated. So these are well known things that that there is a trade off between quantity and quality, and the soils are depleted. But what I think also is a contributing factor, in the one that the researchers didn't necessarily think of, is that CO2 increased, and it's increasing every year. Even if we look back at World War II period, right? Or even if we look at 1980s, the CO2 concentration was maybe 1980s, maybe 350, 360 parts per million. And now we are 410 parts per million. So that I think is a factor. Also, why I think CO2 is a factor, because if you look not just at crops, but if you look at wild plants, right, the ones that we don't fertilize, deliberately at least not, and if you look at the quality of those plants. And there's a Penuelas made such a study. They looked at herbarium specimens several hundred years ago, and they compared with the contemporary ones, and they see that the most minerals declined. Well, that tells you that, you know, that probably very likely, I mean, there were other global changes, you know, warming and so on, but CO2 is one global factor, that there is no corner in the world where CO2 concentration is not higher now than it used to be 100 years ago, right? Or 200 years ago, or even 30 years ago. And, I believe that that's a factor.
So, you mentioned earlier the problem of increased obesity and mm-hmm. increased and decreased, what did you call it, hidden hunger, I believe?
Right.
Among humans. And I want to come back to that in a moment, but is this, and you've also mentioned that in the laboratory that in that one experiment the zooplankton went to zero. Is this, to your knowledge, affecting wild creatures' nutrient intake? Do you know if this is affecting non-humans? And then we're going to come back to humans in a moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good question. So first, there were experiments in 1980s where they grew herbivores, like insects, caterpillars, in elevated and ambient CO2 concentrations. And so the caterpillars would end up eating more plants, presumably because of lower nitrogen or protein content. And from this perspective, we know it affects herbivores when we talk about basic, you know, protein concentrations. There was a fascinating study done recently, where they analyzed cow poop. They have these thousands of samples, tens of thousands of samples of frozen cow poop from the cattle industry. And what's ironic that the cattle industry is so driven by, you know, profits that they really, really know about cow nutrition. They know very well, and they know what cows need to eat to maximize their growth. And by analyzing cow poop, because their sample was so large, they could cut through the noise. And they saw that just over the last, like, 2-3 decades, the quality, and again, they looked at nitrogen or protein, declined in forage to the point where it affects cow growth. So, again, decline of nitrogen is much more well-known issue, and I was focusing specifically on minerals. I don't know if studies directly attributed decline in minerals to animals, but I definitely think that's an issue because many animals are limited by minerals. That's why, you know, there's a geophagy where they literally eat earth or lick rocks to obtain those minerals. So we have some evidence that it does affect animals. There's also interesting studies showing that even wild animals, they become fatter for some reason. There's weight gain even in some wild, you know, mammals. And that goes back to your question, you know, about obesity and other diseases such as diabetes.
So I have to tell you that everything you're saying, I'm finding frankly horrifying. And that, I mean, this is, it seems terrifying stuff to me. And it seems that it hasn't been studied a lot. I have a sentence here in front of me. Among thousands of publications that you had reviewed on plants and rising CO2, he found only one that looked specifically at how it affected the balance of nutrients in rice, a crop that the billions of people rely on. And the paper, published in 1997, found a drop in zinc and iron. And I guess the first question is, and this is a very unscientific question, but I mean, do you find this pretty scary? And second, I know that you've said that this is, you know, the emphasis is primarily on yield, and that's a very good point. nonetheless, we have, I don't understand why there wouldn't be more studies on this. So I guess take any of that where you want, anywhere you want to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, when, back in 2001, I started to think that the minerals should decline in plants, just from basic this, you know, mass balance perspective. And because, you know, also my PhD thesis was actually about a mathematical model that looked at the quality of a phytoplankton. And, you know, the idea was that, you know, that is, you increase light, there is more phytoplankton, but lower quality, and that affects zooplankton. So I essentially replaced light with CO2, thinking, well, CO2 will boost photosynthesis, and that would, you know, make plants worse. And unlike light, CO2 is increasing globally, so that would should affect humans. And when I started to look what humans are limited, and I realized that billions of people don't get those minerals, and the implications for those people are horrendous. You know, like one example is iodine deficiency, right? That actually is the leading cause of preventable lower IQ in children. And we, of course, iodize our salt in developed countries. In many countries, it's still not iodized, and they have goiter and, you know, the retardation and really horrendous issues. Same thing with the iron deficiency for you know, mothers and pregnant women, and zinc deficiency that also steals, you know, the vitality from humans. And that was like, okay, well, that's a huge problem. So what then CO2 does to those minerals? And I started to look at the studies, and I was shocked, really. I couldn't believe that there was so little. And to me, it was very clear, the connection. But, you know, because I was lucky that I didn't come from this agricultural, you know, botanist perspective, I came from mathematics perspective, and was fortunate to be introduced to this science that looked at, you know, all the biology from the simple perspective of chemical elements, which was, as I said, was done by James Elser and with his colleague at the University of Minnesota, Bob Stirner. So with that perspective, to me, it was clear, but very little studies, right? It was one study by Conroy Asinawera in Australia where they looked at rice and, you know, the iron and zinc dropped, but maybe in another study, you know, iron would not drop. And so there was a lot of noise in the system, a lot of noise in the system in terms of, like, you know, statistical noise. And if I talk to experts, right, they would say, well, you know, maybe it's because in those experiments, plants grow in pots. And if you actually grow them in the fields, they will get all the nutrients they need. They can grow bigger roots. Or they would say, you know, actually one, a big shot at Princeton University, he actually was one of the few who was interested in the issue. But he told me, look, come on. I mean, you know, humans need so little iron, they could always, like, eat a little bit of dirt and, you know, get all the iron they need, because, you know, soil is indeed is rich in iron, not necessarily bioavailable, but it's rich in iron. So he was a geoscientist, and he had no idea about the state of human nutrition, and that, you know, there's literally 2 billion people who don't get enough iron. So when experts look from their own perspective, they don't necessarily connect all those dots, and that's why there was this resistance. And so I realized the only way to cut through that is to cut through that noise and have enough data to unequivocally show, okay, look, if we have massive amount of data, we see the signal. We see that plant quality declines, and it declines globally. And since we're already limited by those elements, the situation will be getting worse. So, yeah, it's one of the problems is that by its nature, it is interdisciplinary problem. And unfortunately, a lot of funding usually is for specific disciplines, so it doesn't really fit anywhere to any specific discipline. And that's why I think I encountered so many rejections for my, you know, grant applications.
So I'm still not quite clear on what percentage, like how I understand the problem of not getting enough zinc or not getting enough iron, but I'm not really clear on how much less zinc or iron there would be in a type of plant. How much less nutrition are we getting from rice or potatoes or whatever you want to choose, soybeans, sure. I don't care. Mm-hmm. And how much of that would be attributable, do you think, to CO2? How much is this hurting nutrients?
Sure. So I was collecting all the data from all these experiments that were running on, you know, four continents, not only in greenhouses but in actual fields, and you know, was about over 7,500 observations, pairs of observations, so total over 15,000 observations for 25 different elements in 130 plant varieties. And there is a pervasive, consistent, and geographically widespread decline of nearly all elements on average 8%. Of course, as I said, there is variability, so you know, anywhere from 5 to 15% decline. And you know, nitrogen, as has been known, declines more, maybe 15, 18%. Now, you know, you might say it's not a big deal. You know, what is the 8% decline? And I often hear that, like, you know, it's we fortify our foods. You know, it's very easy to add a little bit of zinc. We actually grow plants in greenhouses, right? And they're delicious and they're tasty. Why, you know, am I an alarmist who just, you know, just raises, you know, think a non-issue? So what really people are missing here is that they think, you know, it's not one time 8% decline of zinc. You know, if I eat today a cereal that has 8% less zinc, or, you know, I eat an apple that has 15% less magnesium, that's not an issue at all. Right? Plants generally have very variable quality. The problem is it's global, lifelong decline with every meal that you eat for all the minerals. Three times a day you eat plants, every time you eat a salad, a pizza, you know, a juice, even a beer or wine, or, you know, any kind of plant-based food, you would have slightly less nutrients there, those essential minerals. What's the cumulative effect? You know, that's the scary question. Not only that, but also the effect is increasing every year because CO2 concentrations are climbing. So it's progressive effect. Now, I want to, you know, know that because very often those, you know, climate deniers or people who are skeptical, they say we raise food in greenhouses and it's nutritious. Yes, I love to eat food from greenhouses, but the problem, greenhouses are controlled environment. The CO2 there is deliberately increased so plants would grow faster, but also soil is enriched. You see, if you can balance increase of CO2 and you enrich soil, you can grow more plants and, you know, nutritious plants. In fact, my original, you know, paper back in 2002, it said about imbalance between CO2 and nutrients. But when we talk about how the vast amount of food is actually grown in the world, it's not grown in greenhouses. It's grown in open fields where, as you already said, the soil is depleted, where we don't add zinc, we don't add magnesium. But what we do is we add, you know, nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, and everywhere for all the plants, we just add more CO2. So that's where this imbalance in the environment translates into plants and affects us. It's the scale that is scary.
And yeah, and I love what you just said, but even when you said 8%, that did actually sound pretty terrifying to me up front. And I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yes, I mean, the, you know, to me, it was, you know, 8%, okay, think this way, right? Essentially, those 8% are replaced, those minerals are replaced with extra starch and sugar. So when I actually did some calculations that you could get the same effect in terms of dilution of nutrients, if you take a spoonful of starch and sugars and you dump it on a, you know, typical plant serving you eat. Well, imagine doing that for the rest of your life, right? What's the cumulative effect? And that is very concerning. And that's where I think, and again, that's unexplored, but I think that's where the link is to possibly diabetes and obesity. You know, the big food industry already injects sugar, which is, you know, one of the cheapest calories, or, you know, refined carbs and high fructose corn syrup. It already injects it in our food supply, right, to maximize profits. And here we do it also by increasing CO2, and we do it for all the plants, whether they're wild, whether they're organic, whether they are just commercial crops.
So, yeah, I mean, what we get, it seems, is blown out insulin receptors.
And I think that you know, slightly worse quality plants with more starch and sugars and increased carbohydrate to protein ratio. And, you know, if we talk about carbohydrate to protein ratio, the increase is substantial. It could be a 30%, depending on a plant tissue, could be anywhere from, you know, 5 to 40%. Higher carbs to protein. And we know that the carbohydrate to protein ratio does affect weight gain.
So we have about 6 or 7 minutes left. Mm-hmm. And what would you, I have a couple, three questions. Mm-hmm. One of them is, what would you, if they somehow put you in charge of the FDA or something, What do you want to see done about this? I mean, apart from stopping global warming, what do you want to see done about this? Where would you like to, for one question, where would you like to see more research?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, on the one hand, I'm not a policymaker, so I'm, you know, reluctant to give recommendations. But if I had a magic wand, I would change the incentives that the entire agriculture is driven by yield. And if farmers were paid not just for calories, but for the nutritional content, then when you start with those incentives, then they will cascade down. Then the farmers will start to think, well, how can we enrich soil? Should we have a better soil? Should we have more minerals in the soil? And the nutritional density really that is neglected for so many years, if it comes to the forefront, then the well-being of all the humans will increase, and the amount of diseases will decrease. But I don't know how to do that, how to change those incentives.
So another question, I want to go back to the phytoplankton, and I wasn't quite clear that the phytoplankton experiments were about increased light, mm-hmm. but does this increased CO2, do you believe, affect phytoplankton the same way that it affects broccoli?
Right, yeah. So the fundamentally plants and, you know, phytoplankton, they all called autotrophs, photoautotrophs. They use, you know, sunlight to make food. They share the same basic biochemistry. And, right. So whether you increase light or you increase CO2, you increase photosynthesis. And the ultimate product of photosynthesis is carbohydrates. The oxygen that we know, it's just a waste product, you know. Plants split the water molecule and just release oxygen, but they grab that hydrogen to make sugars.
So that scares me very much too, because, you know, phytoplankton is really the base of, we could argue that phytoplankton is one of the bases of life on Earth, since this is mainly a water planet.
Yeah, and definitely, yes. Yeah,
so a decrease in nutrient quality of phytoplankton combined with a decrease in actual quantity of phytoplankton in the oceans, there have been studies of decreases in phytoplankton numbers or volume or however you want to put it, mass, that seems to be to suggest things that are not very good for ocean health.
Yeah, I mean, the quality of phytoplankton changes, and also the, you know, another effect of CO2 is increases acidity of water. So that also affects phytoplankton. In terms of effects, yeah, we do see that there are big changes in terms of the structure of food webs and, whether some species adapt or no. And, some of these issues are well known, why I'm concerned about this increase in CO2, because it's such a global, inescapable, pervasive effect that really affects not only marine systems, but also, you know, terrestrial systems, and specifically our agriculture and our nutrition. Literally, what you ate today has been already affected by a higher CO2 concentration.
So I guess I have two questions left to finish up. We got just a couple minutes, and one of them, the first question is, so what are you working on now that has to do with this? And the second question is, what would you like for listeners of this interview to take away? What do you want listeners to understand and do?
I see. Well, one project I work is fascinating. One is about, you know, carotenoids, and that is that gives color to nature. All this red, green, orange. Orange, brown, and red colors. And I was contacted by a researcher from Ireland, John Nolan, who is expert on carotenoids. And turns out we need carotenoids in our eyes, in our macula. We filter blue light that protects our vision. In some way, we and the plants, we share the need for carotenoids to protect against oxidative stress. And he asked me, what will happen? Will carotenoids be affected? And I started to look at that. I didn't know anything about carotenoids, but it's interesting that, you know, as CO2 increases, it helps plants to reduce stress because there is a basic nutrient. So they actually don't have to produce that many antioxidants. So I think, and this is just hypothesis, but we'll have a paper coming up soon, that essentially that carotenoids might decline. So it's not just minerals, but one of the very important nutrients that it has been linked to vision and memory, that might decline as well, or be at least changed, significantly affected by increasing CO2. So that's a current research project. In terms of what your listeners should do, as I say, I'm not a dietitian or policymaker to give recommendations, but I would just maybe point to a couple of trends, right? It's good to be aware that the big food industry uses high fructose corn syrup and sugar to pretty much sweeten everything, right? As you mentioned, it makes things taste better. And so on top of that, now we have this increase in CO2 that also injects extra carbs into the entire biosphere. So be mindful of that, you know, watch the amount of, refined sugars you eat and focus on more nutrient dense foods.
Well, thank you so much for your work in the world, which is just, I think, incredibly important and incredibly fascinating. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Dr. Irakli Loadze. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.